The Buzz About Bees. The honeybee isn't native to North America, but it's the official insect of the state of Maine. With spring finally here, at least according to the calendar, swarm season is upon us. So what better time than now to learn a bit more about bees, their ancestry, biology, and the critical role they play in our complex ecosystem. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we'll learn how to help the bees that live near us survive and stay healthy. We'll also get advice for the hobbyist beekeeper and get some answers as to why bees behave the way they do, why they swarm, and what challenges the bumblebee population has faced in other countries, and what we in the U.S. can learn from those losses. Maine Calling gets the buzz on bees. First, this news. From the MPBN studios in Bangor, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Spring may indeed finally be here, and with spring comes the return of flowers in bloom, growing of gardens, and the buzzing of bees. Today we're going to learn a lot about bees. We'll hear from a bee whisperer who lives here in Maine, and we'll speak with a professor of biology whose new book is all about the bumblebee. And of course, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about bees? Have you thought of becoming a beekeeper? With me in our Bangor studios, Peter Cowan. He's better known as the Bee Whisperer. Peter is also the president of the Penobscot County Beekeepers Association. And on the line with us from the BBC studios in Tunbridge Wells, England, is Dave Goulson. He's the author of A Sting in the Tail, and he's a professor of biology specializing in the ecology and conservation of bumblebees at the University of Sussex. Again, we want to hear from you. You're on our panel as well. The number is 800-399-3566, 800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net, or you can tweet us. We're at Maine Calling, or you can also post to our Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to you both first.
Hello, Keith.
Peter, let's start with you. Where does your interest in bees come from? And specifically, you're a honeybee guy. Where did this all start for you?
I have always had an interest in all sorts of animals. Ever since I was five, I remember a neighbor of us pointing out that I'm going to be a zoologist when I grow up. And certainly, indeed, that's what I turned out to be. I wanted to keep bees since I was about 7 or 8, but my parents, who hadn't had any previous experience in it, were a little reluctant to let me get started on my own. Eventually, when I was 11, my pleading resulted in me being able to buy my first beehive along with my younger brother. And in fact, it was a local beekeeper who was able to provide us with equipment, and we could buy the bees that really allowed me to get started. And
was this in England?
This was in Framingham, Massachusetts, Hopkinton, Massachusetts. In fact, I've moved around New England as a child. I did then later spend another 30 years of my life in the UK, or in the Isle of Man, and in England, and then moved back to Maine about 11 years ago when I took up beekeeping again. While I was at school and the university and running a business in England, I never actually kept bees. But when I moved back to Maine, I started keeping bees, and it had changed an awful lot in that time.
Sure, and we'll talk about why. What was it about bees as a 7-year-old that interested you? There are so many crawly creatures in the world to collect and be interested in. Why bees?
Well, bees are absolutely fascinating. I've always been interested in something which will help me make money, and bees, I saw making honey would have been one of the things that really intrigued me about it. But also it's just absolutely fascinating the way tens of thousands of individuals can work together, none of them with a brain bigger than a pinhead, but they're working together in to form a super organism. And right from day one, that was absolutely fascinating to me. And it grew from there.
Dave Goulson, you write in your book that you were first began to study bumblebees not just because they're important pollinators, but because they're fascinating. You also had a kind of a childhood passion for bumblebees or bees?
Yeah, not just bumblebees, to be fair. It just seems that some people are born with a bug, if, as it were. I was just fascinated, obsessed with wildlife of all sorts, mainly insects. Butterflies were actually probably my first love, really. I started collecting butterflies and putting a pin through them when I was knee-high to a grasshopper. And my earliest memory of bumblebees is from when I was about seven, when, as I recount in the book, I found some bedraggled, soggy bumblebees that had been caught out in the rain and tried to dry them off by putting them on the hot plate of the electric stove, which wasn't such a good idea for the bees, poor things. But yeah, it's hard to say where these things come from. My parents weren't interested in natural history, but somehow I was just born that way.
And what is it about their behavior that interests you, or that you'd like other people to know about?
Well, so I focus mainly not on honeybees at all. I kind of see it as my sort of self-appointed mission in life to champion those other bees that everyone forgets about. A lot of people think there's just one species of bee in the world and lives in a box and it makes honey. And that's a million miles from the truth, that there are something like 22,000 species of bee in the world. So I work on bumblebees, which are the big sort of furry, stripy cousins of honeybees. But then there are loads of other bees as well, and many of them little solitary things that nobody even notices. But they all do important things, pollinating wildflowers or crops or whatever, and we need to look after them all. And they're all fascinating in their different ways. They all have different life histories. Some are social, like the honeybee. Others sort of live in little aggregations, and still others live entirely on their own. So there's a whole world there, and an awful lot we don't yet know about them.
And in your book, you talk about the certain species of bees that are disappearing in some countries, thriving in others, and we'll talk about that a little bit later in the program. Back to honeybees, though, Peter Cowan, you'd said that there was a time when beekeeping was a simpler thing. There were fewer challenges to it. What's changed in the past, say, 30, 40 years?
Well, certainly when I was a kid growing up in the 70s, early 70s was a relatively easy time for keeping bees. At that time, really, you just needed to provide them with a lot of space in the spring and remove a lot of honey in the fall. And the bees' health would, generally speaking, remain pretty good. The habitat was diverse. They had plenty of food. They didn't have some of the problems that they had now. Then what happened in the mid-80s, late 80s, was the introduction of the parasitic mite, the Varroa mite, the Varroa destructor. And that, over a very short period of time, virtually wiped out all wild residing honeybee colonies and also gave beekeepers a major headache in terms of how to keep their honeybees alive, because this parasitic mite was then making the bees much weaker and either killing them through sheer numbers or by the introduction of bacteria and viruses that their bite introduces.
So if someone is interested in beekeeping, it seems from what I read, it's a little more complicated than, you know, say, keeping a few chickens. You have to understand the cycles of breeding and making sure that the honey comes out so that it doesn't sort of clog up the hive. And there's a lot to know, isn't there?
There's certainly plenty to learn about. And the better you understand the biology of the bee and how their colony progresses and grows, the more successful you'll be in keeping bees. The bees do take care of themselves to a very large extent. You do still just have to provide them with the room, but you also have to be aware when problems are starting to develop, whether that is mite buildup, and that's usually the most common, is the buildup of mites in the colony. And you can monitor the levels of mites in the colony, and you can go through, there's a lot of things that you can learn of ways to manage the levels of mites to keep them low. It's called integrated pest management. And you can go so far keeping mite levels low, but there comes a point where the mite levels can build up to a point where you must treat the bees. And without treatment, the colony would therefore die. And so then it's knowing, and over the period of the last 30 years, there's been a lot of development of a lot of different treatments. And so now hobbyists are able to manage mite levels much better. And mites, are, although a serious problem for bees, are just one of the problems that we have to deal with. And beekeeping can still be fairly successful. You can get most of your hives through every winter.
Yeah. Dave Goulson, you have studied the struggle, among other things, you studied the struggle of a certain species of bumblebee in England, which has disappeared. What are the challenges facing bumblebees? In this case, it was it agricultural practices, and what was the bee that you were looking at, and what happened to it in England?
So we used to have 26 species of bumblebee living in the UK, and three of them, in fact, have gone extinct, and others are pretty close to going extinct. The one I've been particularly working on is the short-haired bumblebee, but the factors that drove it to becoming extinct are very similar to the problems that honeybees have had, I think, in many respects. There's one key difference is that the varroa mite doesn't affect bumblebees. The biggest impact on bumblebees has been the intensification of farming, which has resulted in a very tidy countryside, which has very few flowers. If you could rewind the clock 100 years, Britain was full of flower-filled hay meadows and little fields with hedges around them and lots of flowers in those and so on. And it's changed dramatically. And it was a sort of steady process that took 60 or 70 years through the 20th century. Really kicked off on the back of the Second World War, when we had a kind of a need to be self-sufficient in Britain, and farmers were encouraged to intensify their production as much as they could. So that's the biggest thing, is that there really aren't many flowers these days, and not many quiet places to nest. And then on top of that, we've added to the bees' troubles by accidentally spreading bee diseases around the globe. So the varroa mite doesn't affect bumblebees, but some other bee diseases are shared between bumblebees and honeybees. Many of the viruses that affect honeybees also infect bumblebees and so on. And we've moved these things around the world, which is causing big problems for both wild and managed bees. And then just to finish off the three horsemen of the bee apocalypse, as it were, pesticide use has greatly increased, and some classes of pesticide are probably playing a role. And these things interact. So we know, for example, that bees that are exposed to tiny amounts of pesticides become more susceptible to the viruses that are transmitted by the varroa mite and so on. So it's actually that bees are sort of simultaneously threatened by these three different things. Basically, they're hungry, they're diseased, and they're mildly poisoned, and put those three together, and it doesn't look so good.
So are there efforts, though, in England to sort of restore habitat that could support a bee population and bring that population back?
Yeah, so the really funny sort of twist of fate regarding this thing, the short-haired bumblebee, it went extinct in the 1980s in Britain, But very peculiarly, there are short-haired bumblebees of British origin living in New Zealand, which is a place that doesn't naturally have any bumblebees at all. So the story behind that is that farmers in New Zealand in the 1800s, they'd imported red clover to grow as a fodder crop, and they found that it didn't set any seed, and they had to keep importing sacks of very expensive seed from Britain every year. And they obviously weren't very happy about that. And eventually one of them twigged that the reason their red clover wasn't setting any seed is because there weren't any bumblebees in New Zealand naturally at all. So a farmer wrote to his cousin, who lived in Kent, which is where I'm sitting now in England, and said, please send me some bumblebees. And the guy duly did. He stuck them on a refrigerated ship. And they've lived there ever since. There are four species of British bumblebee in New Zealand, and one of them is this thing that's now extinct here, but its descendants are alive and well on the other side of the world, which gives us the chance potentially to bring them back.
But a lot has to change in terms of sort of habitat for those bees.
So obviously they went extinct for a reason, and there wouldn't be a lot of point in bringing them back and just watching them go extinct again. So I've been part of a big project that's been going on now for 5 years to create lots more habitat, to put back some of those flowery meadows that we used to have and persuade farmers to put in wildflower strips and red clover lays and so on in preparation for the release. So we had 3 years of creating habitat. And then 2 years ago, we released the first short-haired bumblebees back into Britain, Queens, almost exactly 2 years ago, that was. And in the first year, it didn't work. We had an awful summer in 2012, and we basically released 50 short-haired bumblebee queens, and they flew away, and we never saw any of them again, and that was the end of it. So we released a bunch more last year, Two months later, we saw worker bumblebees, short-haired bumblebees, on the wing in Britain for the first time since the 1980s. So some of those queens built themselves nests and produced offspring. We're now kind of waiting. They haven't quite emerged from hibernation. They'll be coming out in the next week or so. So we're hoping that some of those nests last year produce new queens that are now hibernating and will come out in a few days' time.
Oh, interesting. Peter, this is also here in Maine. It's swarm season is upon us. Can you explain what that is and what it describes?
Well, certainly swarm season, swarming is the process where honeybees reproduce on a colony level, where the queen will leave the colony along with about half the workforce to set up a new colony. So as opposed to bumblebees, which set out individual queens in the spring and an individual is starting up a colony, the honeybees start off with a great advantage. They have one queen that leaves the colony along with 20 or 30,000 of her daughters who are then going to help her set up a new colony. And they quickly they hang out from around the hive somewhere, usually hanging in a big ball from a tree somewhere for two or three. Maybe a day or two while the scout bees go and find a new location to build a hive. And that might be a hollow tree. It might be a badly fitting soffit on somebody's house. And this is the opportunity that a beekeeper has to capture those swarms before they actually build a new colony. And that's always a great time of year to be out there as a beekeeper catching these swarms. So certainly if anybody comes across it, we're just coming into swarming season now, and it'll go on for the next couple of months.
All right. So if you see this happening, you can let your fellow, your neighbor beekeeper know about this, or the Beekeepers Association?
Certainly, yeah. If you get in touch, go on to mainbeekeepers.org and check out, we've got a swarm hotline there, and you can report a swarm, and we will send a beekeeper out there as soon as possible to collect that swarm and rehouse that swarm.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll talk much more about bees and take your calls, including Lynn, who's calling from Belfast. Lynn will come to you after the break. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Sweetser. Seeking mentors for children with mental and behavioral health needs, learn more at sweetser.org. And Silly's in Portland's East End, open at 11 Tuesday through Friday and at 9 for brunch on the weekends with vegan and gluten-free options, sillys.com.
Next time on The World, three Israelis record a song with a catchy saxophone riff. 7 years later, it's a musical hook for a top 10 tune.
Some people say, hey, I just heard your thing on the radio, and it's actually not you. So what's going on?
How MIDI sounds made a hit on The World.
Join us for The World this afternoon at 3 o'clock. Well, it's May, and MPBN's Life is Better contest is underway. The top prize, thanks to Lee Automalls, is a new Nissan Juke S. Second place prizes, there are two of them, are weekend golf getaways for four at Sugarloaf. The best reward, of course, is the listener-supported programming here at MPBN, and that depends on you. Make a gift before the end of this month. You'll support the programming and be entered into the contest. MPBN Evergreen supporters are automatically entered. No purchase is necessary, void where prohibited. To enter and for full contest rules, visit mpbn.net or call 800-884-1717. Thanks. Life really is better with MPBN, and MPBN is better with you.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, The Buzz About Bees. With me in our Bangor studio, bee whisperer Peter Cowan. He's the president of the Penobscot County Beekeepers Association. And on the line with us from the BBC studios in Tunbridge Wells, England, Dave Goulson, author of A Sting in the Tail, his new book, which has been out about a week, I guess. We invite you to join the conversation. The number, 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll go to Lynn in Belfast, as promised, in a moment. But Peter, you were talking before the break about when swarming occurs and you can see these colonies of bees in a tree, or they're trying to find a new place to hive. And so that's an opportunity for beekeepers to go and get them and sort of bring them to a structured hive to get the honey from. How do you do that? Do you make sure you get the queen, or how do you move a colony?
Well, usually it's hanging like a big, like a something, usually about a basketball-sized group of bees hanging from a tree branch. And you take an empty colony to that spot, and you can literally shake the branch and the bees will drop into the colony, and any that don't drop into the colony will quickly follow the scent that the bees that are in the colony start to produce. They start to open their scent gland and fan it out, and all the bees will suddenly start crawling over everything in order to get into that hive. They'll fly into it. It's amazing. You can be carrying that hive around and all the bees will start following you. They all want to go in. Because once you've dropped that hive in, if the queen is dropped in at the same time, then all the other bees let everyone else know, and they all pile into that one beehive. And then you can move it to a manageable location and start to feed them, and they start to build comb. And that way you've got a beehive. It breaks my heart to hear people spraying them with bug spray or calling a exterminator because they're afraid of the bees. Actually, swarming bees are usually extremely gentle because they're full of honey, so they could virtually not bend their backs over to sting. But also, they don't have a hive to defend. They are out in the open, and they are very, very excited about moving house. But they're usually at their most gentle that they can be at that point.
All right. As promised, now we're going to go to the phones to Lynn in Belfast. Hi, Lynn. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, please. Go ahead, please. You're on the air.
I know. I had asked about colony collapse theory. I read a wonderful article in the New Yorker some years ago, and I just wondered if that was a relevant area that we're still talking about.
It is a relevant area. I'll start with Dave Goulson. I know that you address this in your book. That is the colony collapse issue. Do you want to?
Yeah, sure. Well, as I was saying a few minutes ago, I think most people these days, there's been an awful lot of scientific research going on this issue, and it's still ongoing. I think it's really clear that it doesn't have a single cause. You know, there have been lots of theories, everything from mobile phones to aliens to GM crops to whatever. But I think it's pretty obvious now that there's not one thing that's to blame. It's actually a combination of things that stress bees and can, when the stress gets too much, cause honeybee colonies to die, and also things like wild bumblebee nests to die out. And I think there's pretty good evidence that those three things come down to a poor diet sometimes, or a lack of food. So either the bees don't have enough to eat, or they only have access to one or two types of flower in the very simple agricultural landscapes that we create. And the diseases and parasites that we've accidentally spread around the world that they don't have much resistance to. And on top of that, the exposure to pesticides. And those three things, it may be a slightly different combination of stressors in one place to another. But those three things usually seem to be involved.
And you note, I believe that there are those who say that colony collapse is not new, that there have been instances in previous decades where, going back, I think, to the 19th century, of disappearing bees.
That's absolutely true. It's the frequency of the problems that has increased. You know, bee colonies have died for various symptoms, ever since people started keeping bees, I'm sure. And sometimes there are bad years just caused by bad weather or whatever. But what's been noticeable in the last probably 20 or so years is that those problems are much more frequent. They're much more widespread. And they're happening so often that some beekeepers are, you know, kind of on their knees with the effort of just trying to keep their hives alive. And that is new. That's something that, you know, didn't happen historically.
Yeah. Peter, did you want to add anything?
Certainly, yes. The colony collapse, at least in the USA, seems to be something that's been primarily a real problem for the commercial beekeeper, where they're moving thousands and thousands of hives from one monoculture to the next monoculture to the next monoculture. And this is not a natural thing for the bees. Bees normally have a variety of diet to be able to go to. When they're taken to commercial areas for commercial pollination, there is literally only one type of flower. So it would be like us trying to feed our kids hamburgers for 3 weeks, and then hot dogs for 3 weeks, and then lettuce for 2 weeks, and then bananas for 2 weeks. You'd soon get pretty ill pretty fast. And colony collapse disorder seems to be most severe amongst commercial beekeepers. But all of the other problems, as Dave was saying, it does seem to be a combination of all of the factors which have been giving us problems. But when you factor all of these extra things in together, when you get more than one of these issues happening at the same time, then you've got a synergy where the problems aren't just added together, they're multiplied together. And that results in a lot of extra bee deaths, which wasn't previously happening.
Yeah, Lynn, are you still there?
That's very interesting. I can see that it's trucking them around is terrible. That was mentioned in the article. And then the invention of pesticides, I guess those are the two modern reasons I would see.
Yeah, thank you for calling. It's a big issue here in Maine, of course, because we have these blueberries, other large crops that depend on pollination. In fact, Dave Goulson, you mentioned in your book that in China, for example, they're actually where agriculture has exploded, which tends to be not good for bees. They're actually humans doing pollination.
Yeah, it's very picturesque. I've got these lovely photographs from Southwest China of the local farmers in their traditional dress, hand pollinating every flower in their apple and pear orchards, and they send their children clambering up to get the higher flowers. But it's a really depressing underlying story. You know, the reason they're doing that is because they've essentially wiped out bees in big chunks of China. And they have pretty cheap labor and can just about afford to do it, although I hear that some of them are now ripping out their orchards entirely and replacing them with things that don't need pollinating by bees. But it shows how bad things can get, you know, and obviously we desperately need to make sure we don't do that, because the farmers in Maine, or for that matter in the United Kingdom, haven't got the time to hand pollinate all of their crops.
Sure. Peter, what can we do, say, even if we're not beekeepers or hobbyists ourselves, but we keep gardens, we grow flowers. So what can the average person do to kind of make life easier or better or healthier for bees in general?
Right. Well, certainly there is a big movement for non-beekeepers to become beekeepers. And in fact, I've got 200 students this winter and spring alone learning beekeeping and as a possibility of taking that up as a hobby. And that's absolutely fantastic. The more beekeepers we have, the better. But you don't have to keep bees in order to help them out. One of the big problems bees face, we hobbyist beekeepers have similar problems to the commercial beekeepers, in that the diversity of food available for the bees is declining, whether that's through loss of pastures in some areas, but even in our own front yards, exactly the same thing is happening. People put down weed and feed. They're fertilizing their grass to get the grass to grow nice and green and uniform. And along with it, herbicides are being put down to kill off the dandelions and the clover that would otherwise have grown there. Dandelions are the most wonderful flower for the bees at this time of year. Dandelions are just starting to come out, produce loads of nectar, loads of pollen. And if the bees survive the winter and get to the dandelion bloom, we know, as beekeepers, we know they've made it through the winter. Clover, though, is probably one of the biggest sources of nectar for the bees through the whole year. They probably make a very high percentage of their honey on the clover bloom from mid-June to mid-July. And homeowners can do a lot of things to increase, first of all, try not to make your lawn a monoculture. Try to allow some of the wildflowers to grow in it. But also, if you really have to have a green grassy lawn, plant areas around the edges where you can have a variety of plants growing. Plant wildflowers. Plant a variety of pollen and nectar producing plants in those areas. And particularly if you've got a lot of land, consider trying turning over more of it towards being able to grow a variety of flowers. The bees need that nectar and that pollen to rear healthy young.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. We're talking about bees today. Let's go to Kaylin. Is it Kaylin?
Yeah.
Yes. Hi. Go ahead, please.
Hi. So my question is for Dr. Goulson. My name is Kaylin Bickerman. I'm a PhD student at the University of Maine, and I study bumblebees. And I've actually been trying to rear them for a couple of years now. And one of my colleagues found what he said appeared to be a diapausing queen last fall, right before our first frost. And he dug her up this spring for me. She was still alive, but he brought her in, and she's extremely small. So I'm not entirely sure that she's a queen. So I'm wondering if you've ever heard of a cast besides queens able to survive through the winter.
I never have, no. I mean, we haven't really talked on this show about the life cycle of bumblebees, but you'll know.
Well, now's a good time, I guess we can.
Well, so normally the only thing that survives the winter are the queens, and they're in most bumblebee species, they're much bigger than the worker bees. And so right now, I believe over there, your queens are just about coming out. We've had them out for a few weeks here. So it's first thing in the spring, you see these ginormous bees on the wing, great big, beautiful, stripy things, and they're all the queens coming out of hibernation. And they, unlike the honeybees, they have to build a nest on their own to start with. So they'll find themselves a nest site, usually in a hole in the ground, and ideally one that's got an old mouse nest that gives them some insulation. And they'll build a little ball of pollen in that and lay their eggs in it. And they sit on it and they incubate just like a bird. They shiver themselves to keep warm and to keep the brood warm. And they rear up a batch of workers, which are their daughters, but they're much smaller to start with. And the nest grows through the spring, produces lots of workers, a few hundred workers. And then in summer, it produces new queens and males. They fly off, they mate. And then those new queens, as soon as they're mated, they burrow into the ground and hibernate right through to the next spring. And everything else dies off. The males, they only live for a few weeks. The old queen and her nest and all the workers will eventually just perish. And so the only thing that normally survives through the autumn and winter are newly mated queens. I've never heard of workers, or for that matter, males, going through the winter. So I can't answer what the question as to what this peculiar small overwintering bee is. I'd be fascinated to have a look at it. Be very happy to, if you send me photos, I'll sure. See if I can take any guesses. But it would be a new thing. The only slightly related thing I can think of is that in the UK these days, one of our bumblebee species has stopped hibernating. So it's actually our commonest bee. It's called the buff-tailed bumblebee. And about 15 years ago, we started seeing workers flying around in the winter. And it seems that some of the nests just carry on all year round, and partly perhaps climate change. But I think the main reason is that we grow lots of winter-flowering garden plants. There wouldn't naturally be any flowers in Britain in January and December and so on. But in gardens there are, and that's what they're using. So we now do have bumblebees through the year, but I hadn't heard of anything like that over there. And as I say, I really can't say what your mystery bee is, but please send me a picture and I'll have a look.
Of course.
All right, Kaylin, we'll make sure you can connect with Dave and send those pictures over there. We'd like to see the picture too. Maybe we can get it on our Facebook page for everyone to look at. Right now, though, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Andrucki & Associates, representing clients in matters of divorce, parental rights, and prenuptial agreements. Learn more at AndruckyLaw.com. And Revision Energy, working with Mainers to reduce fossil fuel use with the installation of solar panels. RevisionEnergy.com/MPBN.
On the next Fresh Air, seedy casinos, inveterate gamblers, and high-stakes poker. Author Colson Whitehead tells us how a magazine recruited him to enter the World Series of Poker as an amateur and report on the experience. He trained in Atlantic City and ended up at the tournament in Las Vegas playing for a chance at millions of dollars. Whitehead's new book is called The Noble Hustle. Join us.
Fresh Air tonight at 7. Do you know a high school junior or senior interested in radio? Well, MPBN's Patty White is the guest instructor this summer for a week-long radio production course that's sponsored by the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies. MPBN is a partner for this week-long event in Portland, where students will learn the key elements to making good radio and put their newfound skills to use interviewing subjects and producing their own stories. Students will work in teams while in the field. In addition to instruction, students will also learn to use state-of-the-art digital audio recording devices. The course is open to incoming high school juniors and seniors only and will be limited to 9 students. Classes and field work take place from July 21st through the 25th, but applications are needed to be submitted early. For complete information about the SALT Radio Camp, visit mpbn.net and click on Events. Thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, The Fascinating World of Bees. With me in our Bangor studio, Peter Cowan, president of the Penobscot County Beekeepers Association. And on the line with us from the BBC studios in Tunbridge Wells, England, Dave Goulson, author of A Sting in the Tail. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call. That's 800-399-3566, 800-399-3566. In the last segment, Peter, we learned about the life cycle of the bumblebee. Honeybee is a little different. Can you give us a quick primer?
Sure. We talked about swarming, which is the colony-level reproduction, but in the hive itself, the queen is the mother of all of the bees. She will lay eggs. If they're fertilized eggs, they will become worker bees or potentially a future queen bee, and also unfertilized eggs become drones or male bees. And a honeybee colony can have between 40 and even up to 100,000 bees in a very strong honeybee colony. And they will be rearing their young through the spring, building up the strength of the colony and collecting lots of pollen and nectar. And actually, they build a surplus of honey. So unlike the honey bumblebees, which collect enough nectar to survive periods where they can't fly and they can make very small stores of food, honeybees build enormous stores of food. And this is what makes them so attractive to man in the first place, was that they make a huge surplus of honey, which can then keep tens of thousands of bees alive over the winter. And forget everything you ever heard about bees being cold, insects being cold-blooded. Honeybees and bumblebees, as Dave was saying, they generate heat, they incubate their young, where honeybees will be keeping those colonies warm well into the 90 degrees in the wintertime. So while the temperature was minus 20 outside, inside my bee colonies this winter, it was 98 degrees, warm enough for them to raise their young. And so they require an awful lot of food in order to do that.
And you actually need to remove the honey or it causes problems?
No, not necessarily. No. What you may be thinking of there is if you have too much honey in the hive and it starts to fill up the brood chamber, if it does it too early in the year, the colony will not be able to produce enough young. And so then the colony would swarm because they're already full. Basically in the fall, the bees want to fill up every nook and cranny they can in the hive with honey so that they've got enough to last the winter. And typically in Maine, the brutal winters we get here, the bees require over 100 pounds of honey to survive the winter.
Let's go back to the phones to Newberg and Alan. Hi, Alan. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, I had a question about a very interesting program, too. I had big curiosity about bees and stuff. My brother keeps a few, and I had an uncle that did. And I was just kind of curious about the killer bee. I seem to have a bunch of these black, and they look like a honeybee. They're about the same size, buzzing around my building. And I'm kind of curious what to watch for. I mean, I don't want to get snarled up in a nest of them things.
Yeah. So, Dave Golson, first of all, what are killer? We've heard about killer bees. They make a lot of headlines. They have a good name, I guess. What are they, and where are they?
Killer bees. Basically, a few decades ago, a guy in South America was trying to cross European bees with the African strain of the honeybee. And the reason he was doing that is because the African bees have some advantages. They're more productive. Their nests, they gather more honey. And they're also actually, as it turns out, more resistant to things like the varroa mite that we were talking about earlier. So he was trying to, but they're much more aggressive. And he was trying to produce a strain of bee that had the best of both, that was nice and docile, like the European honeybees that you guys normally have. But that was as productive and disease-resistant as these bees from Africa. Unfortunately, he accidentally let a whole bunch escape, which hadn't been part of the plan at all. And they've been spreading and, to a large extent, replacing the more docile European bees as they spread. So they've spread up from South America through Central America and into the southern states. Their exact distribution these days, I'm not sure of. They do occasionally kill people. You know, they're just more aggressive. And in every other respect, they're very productive honeybees. But if you're very unlucky and in the wrong place at the wrong time, and then you can be in trouble.
Peter, are there, first of all, any evidence of killer bees in Maine or any other species of honeybee that hasn't been here or wasn't introduced here or has come from other places?
Well, what we refer to the killer bee is an Africanized honeybee, and they carry the genes, those aggressive genes, and typically, as we're saying, that they've been confined to the southern United States, but with colonies getting moved around all of the time, it can be that some of those hives move into northern regions. Maine brings in 75,000 honeybee colonies to pollinate the blueberries. We bring the second highest number of any state, bar California. And so we bring in about 3 billion bees into the state of Maine every spring to pollinate the blueberries. But then they're trucked out again. Now, there is some evidence that sometimes some of those Africanized, or at least the aggressive type bees, come into the state, but very, very rarely. And it's typically more to do with who the queen bee has mated with, because we buy our queen bees from areas where normal European bees are bred, but there are Africanized drone bees out flying when these queen bees are mating. And occasionally, when the queen bee mates with 20 or so different males, one or two of them might be an Africanized bee. And so she may have a tendency to lay some eggs which tend to be more aggressive than others. But in terms of having killer bee colonies or Africanized bee colonies in Maine, it's almost certainly not the case. We can get some hot hives, some aggressive hives, and when a beekeeper encounters them, he usually replaces the queen with one that's been bred to be a European bee and not having those issues. And so going back to Alan's call, I'd say without being able to see the bee itself, it's probably more likely a wasp of about the same size as the honeybee. It can be a honeybee, but in terms of whether they're going to be really aggressive or in danger in any way, that's very, very unlikely. But by all means, if he's concerned about it, he should have somebody with some experience with bees to have a look at them and see where they are and see if it's more convenient for him to have those bees relocated.
Sounds good. Let's go to Michael in Portland. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yes, I was recently traveling in the Yucatan of Mexico, and our group went on an ecotourism excursion into the jungle, and we visited with some native Mayans who are raising honeybees and have been for thousands of years that do not sting. I was wondering if there are other breeds like that that can be used in Maine.
All right. Honeybees. Yeah, Dave?
I'm sorry for jumping in. They're not honeybees. They're called stingless bees. There are lots of species of them in the tropics, in South America, Central America, and they were traditionally kept by native peoples, have been for millennia, for the honey. They're not as productive as honeybees. They do have the big advantage that they don't sting, hence the name. But I don't think they'd stand any chance of surviving in the climate of Maine. They're all tropical and subtropical beasts, I'm afraid. So I wouldn't try importing them. It would be illegal anyway, I'm pretty sure.
All right, let's go to Aquasic and Joe. Hi, Joe. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Hey, guys. How's it going? I've had
great.
Some bad luck lately. I tried raising bees up in Aquasic, which is in the northwest mountains of Maine. 2 years ago, I got I got equipment. I bought the pound. You know, you get the pound of bees with the queen. They did pretty well. My hive got attacked by a bear. I caught it in mid-act. I recovered the hive. About a month later, they swarmed. I don't know really why they swarmed, because it wasn't overpopulated. I tried cutting the swarm down out of a 50-foot spruce tree. And I guess I never got the queen. I caught it in a tarp like three times. I tried putting it in another colony, and they kept swarming out. And then after about 3 or 4 days of trying this, they finally took off. Well, the following year, I got another pound of bees. This was last year. And about a week later, they all just left. So am I in just a bad area? Is it too cold up there, not enough flowers, or what?
Yeah, so what? Sighting is important, right, Peter?
Yes, sighting is important. And, Joe, I feel your pain, having just had a bear destroy 7 of my colonies over this weekend. It is unusual whereby you install a package of bees and they abscond as they have done. I would be concerned of the equipment that you're using, perhaps what it was painted with is one possibility. It could be that other factors, environmental factors, if it's too cold or some other factors. Certainly in terms of losing the original hive when they swarmed and you tried to recapture them, I've tried getting them out of a tree by even felling the tree down, and often what will happen is you'll kill the queen in the process, and what you have is the bees going out because they think the queen is elsewhere. But in terms of the second hive absconding from the hive, that's much more unusual. I'd probably need to know a bit more about what was going on. By all means, if you're on Facebook, you can contact me at The Bee Whisperer on Facebook, and I'd be happy to talk to you about it afterwards. Maybe you can send me a bit more information. Alternatively, you can email me at Peter Cowan, that's Peter, C-O-W-I-N, at TDS.net. And by all means, send me an email and pictures or something like that, and I'd be happy to discuss it with you.
And we'll have contacts also on our Maine Calling Facebook page, I'm sure. Let's work in Nancy in Deer Isle. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, this is Nancy in Deer Isle, and I'm really glad this is going on today. We just got a healthy grant from the Maine Farmland Trust to have 4 new hives on Deer Isle this summer. And so we are going to be starting with the Waray hives, and I'm wondering if you are familiar with the Waray hive, the top bar hive.
Peter, any idea?
I'm familiar. I haven't used most of the alternative style hives. I've seen the top bar hives. My personal opinion is that top bar hives do tend to struggle much more in Maine environments. Mainly, this is my own opinion, I think some others believe the same, is that the bees, top bar hives have lots of parallel combs. And the difficulty that bees face in a really cold winter is getting from one comb to the next comb. They can travel up combs and along combs quite successfully, even in very cold conditions. But moving from one comb to the next comb forms a physical barrier, which it's sometimes hard for the bees to get past, particularly in a cold environment.
And for more information, we're going to run out of time here, so she can find out more from you
by all means.
With that same email address. Dave Goulson, I wanted to give you a chance here before we go to talk about your book, A Sting in the Tail. It's out now in the U.S. about a week. Is that right?
Yeah, it came out a week ago. It's basically it's sort of two books in one. It's a book that will tell you loads about bumblebees. That might sound a little bit dull to many people, but I'm told that it's the least boring book about bumblebees ever written.
There's a lot of funny stories in there. Yeah.
A kind of personal account of growing up and how my interest in bees developed. And hopefully we'll kind of draw people in, and I'm sure they'll enjoy it.
All right. Well, thanks for being here today. Really appreciate it. And thanks to you as well, Peter. And your website for the beekeepers?
Beewhisperer.us for my website, and The Bee Whisperer on Facebook.
All right. Peter Cowan, better known as The Bee Whisperer, president of the Penobscot County Beekeepers Association, and Dave Goulson is the author of A Sting in the Tail. He's a professor of biology specializing in the ecology and conservation of bumblebees at the University of Sussex. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. John Keimel ran the board. We had additional help from Rich Tozier and the MPBN web team, and you can find past editions by going to mpbn.net. Tomorrow on the program, Jennifer Rooks gets all of your answers on gardening and your questions as well. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.